This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many of the New York Times bestsellers. For listeners of this podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/sword. That's audiblepodcast.com/sword.
And by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create a professional website, blog, portfolio, or online store. For a free trial and 10% off your first purchase on new accounts, go to squarespace.com and use offer code SWORD6.
This podcast is part of the Frog Pants Studios Network. For more information about this and other shows, visit frogpants.com. Audio program so good, it's like you're there.
Sword and Laser, I'm Veronica Belmont, and I am actually in Hawaii this week, so we'll be presenting you with our final interview from the Nebula Awards with author Gene Wolfe. In this interview, I'm joined by forum mod extraordinaire Josh Lawrence, and Tom and I will be back next week for our wrap-up of Among Others and our kickoff for the July book pick. Now, there's still time to vote, so head over to Goodreads now and make your voice heard. But without further ado, let's jump right in with Gene Wolfe.
So when we read Shadow and Claw, there was debate on our forums about categorizing it as science fiction or fantasy. Some argued the fantasy elements were just a disguise over what they saw as clearly a science fiction story, while others claimed the fantasy elements were integral to it. Now, I know you have your own term, science fantasy, to describe it. Can you talk about science fantasy as contrasted with science fiction?
Well, you know, science fantasy is science fiction told with the voice of fantasy. Mm-hmm. Science fiction tends to be told with the materialistic voice that people think that scientists really have, which is much more a matter of popular perception than it is the way that actual scientists necessarily are. But science fantasy allows for the unknown, the unsolved, the mysterious coincidences that run across all of us. We all run across, although many of us edit them out of our lives, and we say, oh, that never really happened, and never tell anybody about it, and so on and so on. There are good reasons for not telling people, because I've told people some of mine, and of course get a reputation as a horrible liar, which fiction writers always get. People always assume that because the fiction didn't actually happen, you were a liar any time that you tell them anything, which is far, far from true. You know, we get that stuff out of our system and we sell it. Mm-hmm. And we're not moved to tell tall tales. There's a girl that comes to science fiction conventions sometimes who will tell you lies for as long as you will listen. And I wonder sometimes if it wouldn't be a good thing for her to get into therapy and stay there for about 20 years. But she will tell you how she is, in fact, an FBI agent, and her experiences in the CIA, and on and on and on with this stuff. And it's none of it true. I sat one time and thought, I'm going to see how long she will keep this up. If I, that must have been terrible, you know, and this sort of thing. And she wore me out. After about 3 hours, I couldn't take it anymore. She was still going strong.
Well, she should become a writer, obviously.
She should become something. But I don't know what she really is. Of course, you can't find out what a person like that really is. Because, you know, she's probably a clerk in a department store or something. And she has this incredible fantasy life for herself. I did a story about that called Beach Hill. And it's about pretenders, a convention of pretenders. Mm-hmm. There was a man who pretends that he is an animal trainer and so on and so forth. And I still like that story, although I'm probably the only person on earth who remembers it. When I was signing last night, I had people come and bring around stories, and I thought, oh my God, I haven't thought of that story in 20 years. But he's right, I wrote this thing. And I would read the first few lines and see if they were familiar. No, might have just as well have been written by John Jones, you know.
It's a forgotten children of yours.
Yeah. I've written over 200 stories. I don't know, probably somewhere between 200 and 300 short stories. And some of them I've just blanked out. There are some that I really like and I remember, like The Detective of Dreams. But there are a bunch that just...
Yeah. Well, this next question from Ed may be related to that. Mm. He wants to know, do you have any plans to write another Latro book? Will Latro ever get home or be reunited with his friends? Or is the open-ended nature of Latro's journey supposed to signify that one can never get back to that which one has lost?
I don't know if I will ever write another Latro book. I may. Those take a lot of research. On the other hand, the research can be wonderful fun. The most recent one was Soldier of Sidon, much of which takes place in ancient Egypt. And I had wonderful fun researching ancient Egypt and finding out how very different the real thing was from our perception of it. We tend to think that the ancient Egyptians were morbid because we find all the grave goods and so forth, and they weren't morbid. They were intensely patriotic, which came as a surprise to me. They had a society in which the small farmers who constituted the great bulk of their population were taxed one-third of the produce of their farm, but that was it. They paid that one-third, and their taxes were paid, and there were no further taxes. And every farm actually belonged to some powerful person or entity. The farm might belong to a temple, for example, or it might belong to some very wealthy individual, or to the pharaoh. Many of the farms belong to the pharaoh, meaning essentially the Egyptian government. By the way, the pharaoh was the high priest of every temple in Egypt, meaning that if he needed to raid the temple treasury, he did it completely legally as high priest of that temple. He took the money and did whatever he thought he needed to do with it, except that they didn't have money. The Egyptians invented so much stuff, and they never invented currency. And in Soldier of Sidon, there at this time, Latro's period, they had been conquered, and who the hell had it? My God. Okay, I should not have started this. I have blanked on it. It must have been the Persian Empire at that time. Yeah, Persian Empire. That was the one where the king of Persia, Darius or Xerxes, their kings were all named either Darius or Xerxes. Mm-hmm. Darius was succeeded by Xerxes, who was succeeded by Darius, who was succeeded by Xerxes. Put his brother in charge of Egypt, and you thought, my God, what a setup for a rebellion and seizing the throne and everything. Because his brother now is in charge of this large, powerful country, which had been militarily very successful and active and so on until it finally fell twice to Persia. And he's asking for trouble, and it turned out that his brother made absolutely no trouble and was a loyal governor to his brother, the king, throughout his life. Everything worked out great. But I'll shut up about it because I tend to go on about Egypt much more than I ought to. Much more than I know, I suppose, really.
I'm actually going to stop for a second and move this computer because the fan is very loud. It's driving me as an audio producer crazy. Can you put this over by the other side of the careful of that? As far away from me as possible.
Yes.
Okay.
All right.
Oh, that's so much better. Okay.
Okay.
Do you want to do the next question?
Sure. Got another question?
Oh, we have many questions.
Yes. Good. So, Jorge Luis Borges is often cited as an influence on Book of the New Sun, with Baldanders and Father Nyer's fish being creatures from Borges' Book of Imaginary Beings, and some have suggested that the librarian Olton is modeled on Borges. What draws you to Borges, and which of his stories had the greatest influence on you and why?
Ooh, that is hard to say. Lord. And my Borges is rusty now. I went through a period in which I read all the Borges I could find, and I also went to a lecture of his. I never got to actually meet him, but I did see him in the flesh. I was sitting in the audience, and he went out. He's just the most marvelous old man.
Yeah, I've watched some videos of him, and he just has a super charming presence.
Yeah, he comes out, this old blind man. He has two young people with him. And they say, we are from the Spanish department of Northwestern University, which was about the lecture thing. And we're here to interpret for Señor Borges as necessary. And he begins to speak. He has English down absolutely pat. He has a Spanish accent, yes, but he has a bigger vocabulary than 90% of the audience. I never heard him make a grammatical mistake in English. He was just marvelous. And he said, I do not have any prepared speech to give. If you will ask a question, I will endeavor to answer them, and if you have no questions, I'll leave the stage. And so somebody asked a question. He answered that first question for 45 minutes. And then he started getting questions in high school Spanish. And he would pretend, at least, that he could not understand high school Spanish and get his interpreters to interpret it into English, in which
the inverse
he understood,
right?
You know, he was great. He was great. Last night in the Garden of Forking Paths, I think.
That story is incredible. I just reread Labyrinths recently.
Yeah, and my Borges is too rusty.
Oh, that's a great one to start with, for sure.
It is. It's a great story, and he has a lot of great stories.
Hello, it's Veronica again. Sorry for the brief interruption, but we need to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Squarespace. Squarespace, as you guys know, is the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create a professional website, blog, portfolio, or online store. Of course, swordandlaser.com has been built completely on Squarespace. Since its platform upgrade last fall, Squarespace just keeps rolling out tons of brand new product features, integrations, and templates. And to make sure you get the most from their recent innovations, Squarespace has a 24/7 support team. They do live chat during the week, and they always get back to you over email right away. Plus, plans start at just $8 a month for software and hosting. It's a really great value. Of course, as you know, if you've ever used the service before, it is exceptionally well designed. I can make a website pretty easily, and I'm not exactly skilled in website design. They take care of everything for you. They also just added a new calendar feature called the Events Collection that allows you to share schedule updates. You know, if you have store sales or band tour dates, maybe we'll do something for our Sword and Laser live shows going forward. And they just released a new template called Momentum, which has cinematic full bleed image display. It's great for photographers and designers to showcase all of their work. It's totally fast and easy to use, very powerful and flexible e-commerce solutions built right in, and the mobile experience is great too. So if you'd like a free trial, head over to squarespace.com, sign up for a free account, and make sure to use the offer code SWORD6, that is SWORD6, and you'll get 10% off your first purchase on new accounts. And don't forget about the free domain registrations. And just remember, that is squarespace.com, and the offer code is SWORD6. This podcast is also brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many of the New York Times bestsellers. For listeners of this podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. And we may recommend The Ocean at the End of the Lane by Neil Gaiman. And if you want to get that, head over to audiblepodcast.com/sword. That's audiblepodcast.com/sword. And also, by the way, he also narrates it, which is awesome. Okay, back to Gene Wolfe. So our next question comes from Jenny, who wants to know which authors outside the genres of Sword and Laser, that's sci-fi and fantasy, inspire you either as a writer or as a reader?
Well, I would immediately cheat and say G.K. Chesterton. And Chesterton did a whole bunch of marvelous essays, books and books, wonderful essays. But he also wrote one of the very best fantasies ever, which is not a big, thick book. You can read it very easily, The Napoleon of Notting Hill. Hmm. And it's a future in which they have divided London up into tiny quasi-medieval principalities. And these little principalities begin to war among each other and so on. And it's just a lovely book. And he wrote The Man Who Was Thirsty, which is quite famous. And that is about a circle of spies, seven spies, all of whom take the names of the days of the week as their code name, with Sunday being the head of the spy ring. And Thursday, of course, is a policeman who has penetrated and is posing as a spy and spying on the spy ring, so to speak. And it goes on from there. That, again, is fantasy, because it turns out that Sunday is actually God. And a bunch of stuff.
That's awesome.
So I love Chesterton. Dickens, yes. I don't like everything Dickens did, but I like some of the things that Dickens did an enormous amount. And I began reading him when I was 14 or something like that, mm-hmm. with the Pickwick Papers, which went on from there. And I had a friend who began talking like Mr. Jingle, from the Pickwick Papers and never really stopped. He just locked in on that. It suited him so well. His name was David Taylor, and I miss him. He got a master's, I believe, in psychology and became an Air Force psychologist. And, well, he had, after that, he had a tragic life, let's put it like that, and he's now dead. And I wrote a little story in which I brought him back, and it was such fun to get him back from the dead like wow. that. What in the world? I can't think of what the name of the story was. Rats. Okay. It'll come to me when I don't need it.
Is that, so this is maybe kind of personal, but is that something that writers do a lot?
I don't do it much. I can't think of another case where I've really taken a single person that I knew and used him as a character, which is what I did in that story, whatever the title is. It's about a man who finds a secret scroll that holds the secret of the universe.
And our audience will find it, I'm
he
sure.
Can, with knowing this, he can get anything he wants right now. If he wants beautiful women, he can have beautiful women. If he wants millions of dollars, he can have millions of dollars. And all that sort of thing. It's
usually a price that comes with that kind of scenario, though.
Yeah.
I'm assuming.
Yeah. But anyway, I like that story, and I wish I could think what the name of it is, what the title is. So often I can remember the plots, and I can't remember the names of the characters, and I can't remember the title I put on the story. And
well, you haven't very prolific.
That's sad.
So.
Well, as I said, between 200 and 300 short stories, and that's an awful lot of short stories.
It is.
And I've written over a long space of time. I began writing in either late 1956 or more likely early 1957. And, you know, that's a long time ago now. 55 years or something like that. And
was there a specific point at which you knew you were going to, or you decided to dedicate yourself full-time to writing? Because I knew you were an engineer for a while, right?
Oh, yeah. I have an engineering degree. I got a Bachelor of Science in Mechanical Engineering from the University of Houston. And a while back at that table down in up in the hospitality room, we had a guy who was a chemical engineer. He had a chemical engineer's degree from the University of Houston. But anyway, I did that for 17 years, and then I got a job as a technical journalist. I woke up one morning, and Rosemary was crying in bed, and I tried to find out what the trouble was, and she was just homesick. And I had grown up in Peoria, and she always missed Peoria. She wanted to get back, and she missed the neighbors, and she missed her relatives, and she missed the town, I think, more than anything else. We were living in Cincinnati at that time because I was working for Procter & Gamble, which is a lousy outfit in many respects. Don't put that in your interview. Edit that out, if you would, please.
Okay.
Was that the time you revolved the Pringles process, right?
Yeah. They got the rights to Pringles from this German who basically had invented it. And he had invented the dough-making process, and you fried it in deep fat and so on. But we needed to make them, you know, $1,000 a minute to make any money off of it. And I was a design engineer on the cooker for Pringles. So I was the guy that cooked them. Len Hooper, who was my office mate, rolled out the dough and cut the shapes and deposited it on my cooker, and I ran it through the cooker. And then somebody else picked them off and ran them through the salter and so on. The neat thing about Pringles is you can put them on a vibratory conveyor. They're little these saddle shapes, and they will march along on the vibratory conveyor until they're stopped. And when they're stopped, they'll upend like this and stack themselves.
They stack themselves?
Yeah. And nice. All you have to do is have a mechanical claw like that reaches down and picks up the stack when it gets so big and puts it in the can.
That's genius.
You don't have to worry about stacking the damn things. Just give them a little help and they'll stack themselves.
It's almost too ingenious. Like they have a plan.
Self-organizing chips.
Yes.
Yeah, and when they come out of the salter, when they've just been cooked and they come hot out of the salter, they are unspeakably delicious.
They're so delicious.
The tendency is just to stand there at the salter and eat Pringles.
You can't just eat one. I mean, that's the whole point. Once you pop, you can't stop.
Right.
You just have to eat the entire can.
Yeah.
Evilly delicious. Our next question comes from Tom, who first of all says, thank you for many enjoyable and fulfilling hours reading your works. But he wants to know, have you ever been approached by any prominent screenwriters, actors, or directors seeking to adapt your work? And if so, please do tell.
No, I have sold the, oh, what do you call it? I can't think of a term for it.
The rights?
They have for 6 months, they own right to sell the screen rights.
Okay.
And then after 6 months, the license expires unless they buy it again.
So usually, they optioned it.
That's right. It's an option. I have sold the option to The Shadow of the Torture 2 or 3 times. The movie has never been made. I never knew who was behind the buying of the option, and to be honest, wasn't very interested in it. When you sell an option, you have maybe one chance in 20 that a film will actually be made of it. And so if you're sane, you just take the money and stick it in your pocket and don't worry about it, you know. That's as far as I've ever gone.
If that did get to an actual production stage, would you then be anxious about how they were adapting your work?
I would be, but I wouldn't have any control over it. Mm-hmm. There is no way that they are going to give you any creative control.
Go ahead, Pete.
Okay. There's an anthology coming out August 27th called Shadows of the New Sun. It has stories by Neil Gaiman, David Brin, Nancy Kress, Joel Haldeman, and many others.
And me.
And you, 2 new stories by you, and the other stories are all honoring your work. Could you tell us about that project? Will we get to revisit characters from the New Sun or other solar cycle books in
You'll
any
get
of the
to
stories?
Visit some of my characters as handled by other people. Yes.
Interesting, okay.
But not as handled by me.
Okay.
I did not write New Sun extension stories for the thing. This was cooked up by my friends Bill Fawcett and Gene Raby. Gene is the editor of the Cepheid Bulletin, the slick paper magazine that you have seen there. And Bill Fawcett is a historian and kind of a packager and wheeler dealer. And together they cooked up this thing. And I am happy to say, made no money from it at all, because they contributed the money that they got to me, gave it to me, and most of the story writers gave me the money. This is when Rosemary was in the nursing home, and I was still having to pay for the nursing home, which was running about $8,000 a month. And eventually, I was able to get the state of Illinois to pick it up, but they don't pay the back amounts that you have been paying out, and I had paid out, I don't know, $40,000 or something like that at that point to the nursing home. But my wife has arthritis and diabetes and Alzheimer's disease. The Alzheimer's disease got worse and worse and worse, and I nursed her for years. And finally, the medical people kind of backed me into a corner and said, listen, you can't do this anymore. She is at the stage where one person, no matter how devoted, cannot take care of her. And she was falling down a lot then. And I knew when she fell down twice in the same day, I was in real trouble, because she had been falling down and would fall down maybe once a month or something like that. And then she fell down twice in one day. But anyway, they said, you're going to have to put her in a nursing home. So I did. And this anthology was cooked up as a way to get me some additional money. And it's very kind of them.
It's a wonderful community.
That's great. Yeah.
Yeah. You'll see Jay something Mooney credited on the title page as one of the editors. The editors are Bill Fawcett and Mooney. And Mooney is actually a pseudonym for Gene Raby.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to answer our questions today.
Well, thank you.
We have a lot of huge fans in the audience, and I'm sure they're very excited to hear what you have to say.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Can I somewhere, you're through now.
Yes.
I don't get to say anything more.
You go if you would like to. Yeah,
I just wanted to mention that I will have a new book coming out in November.
That was going to be my next
question. The Land Across.
Go ahead. Tell us about it.
Okay. It's about a young American who travels to an obscure little Eastern European country and gets into all sorts of trouble. And as I told someone, there are two attractive young women in it. There's an attractive older woman. There's a crazy cult. There is a truly evil cult. And much other stuff, boats and so on, that go on in it. And when I got through giving the whole description, I thought to myself, my God, I forgot dogs and motorcycles. I've got everything else in there, but no dogs
almost
and no motorcycles.
Almost the perfect recipe, yeah.
He goes to prison, and he ends up as a member of the secret police of this little Eastern European dictatorship. And I had a lot of fun with it.
Excellent.
Well, I'm looking forward to that.
And that's coming out in November?
November.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Gene Wolfe, thank you very much.
Okay, that at least is what David Hartwell says.
Can't wait to check it out. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, that is it for this episode of Sword and Laser. Thank you guys so much for listening, and sorry for the delay on the wrap-up for Among Others, but we will be back next week. But in the meantime, if you want to get in touch with us, the website is swordandlaser.com. Our email address is feedback@swordandlaser.com. Give us a call, 415-7-SWORD-6. And of course, all of our discussions happen over on Goodreads. We'll see you next week.